into another edition of The Debate. From me, Cover Time, for the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Pentagon says it is not withdrawing troops from Africa after President Donald Trump ordered the repositioning of the majority of U.S. forces out of Somalia. The U.S. sets a new daily record of coronavirus cases with more than 225,000 infections and reports over 2,500 new deaths. Also coming up, the British Premier and the European Commission President are to hold a crisis call to broker a post-Brexit trade deal after a week of talks failed to materialise. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, US President Donald Trump has ordered the removal of most American military and security personnel from Somalia. The US Defense Department said the relocation of the majority of personnel and assets will take place by early 2021. The Pentagon also stressed that the United States is not withdrawing or disengaging from Africa. The US Africa Command has maintained some 700 troops personnel from other U.S. security operations and private security contractors in Somalia. The U.S. has been involved in building up a specialized commando brigade in the country. Washington claims that the commandos are to help government forces fight off terrorists. David Barkin is a commentator and economist joining us out of Mexico City. What do you see as the main motive behind Trump's order to withdraw troops from Somalia?
Well, Trump has long held that the removal of U.S. troops from many of its overseas bases it has been an important part of its platform. I really celebrate this move on his part. Your report talks about the contradictory nature of the Defense Department, which is saying, well, we'll follow the president's orders and take our troops out of Somalia, but we'll leave them in most of the rest of the continent. So U.S. troops over the past 10 years have wrought a huge amount of damage and killed lots of people throughout of civilians throughout the Somalia hinterlands, and it's very, very clear that the U.S. presence there has not done anything either to undermine the guerrilla operations or to make the government a more effective institution for being able to restore order in the country. The Somalia is a story of a tremendous tragedy, human tragedy, in which armed forces are making human and material devastation, and the worst sufferers, of course, are the population.
And David, critics of U.S. military presence outside the United States would say when they're not withdrawing, they're relocating troops. For example, like in the Middle East, they move them from Western Iraq to Eastern Syria and so on. Is there a concern there also in Africa?
It's exactly the same. The U.S. Department of Defense, it's the War Department, is maintaining a very, very strong position throughout Africa. And if they withdraw from Somalia, that's a strategic political decision that will not allow for, will not contribute to strengthening of Somali institutions, nor will it relieve the suffering of most of the Somalian people. And moving those troops elsewhere is just another part of the Defense Department's game to hold on to bases and continue what I would describe as U.S. imperialism, military imperialism, throughout the Third World.
And finally, David, so you see it as an attempt by Trump to try and fulfill his campaign promise to stop America's, you know, endless wars, as he refers to them as. But why leave it so late?
I think that its positioning, its political gaming for his position in the United States, because it's very, very clear that he is now positioning himself to become an important part of the vociferous Republican political campaign to not support, but perhaps even to undermine the Biden presidency and strengthen his own position, perhaps to run for a new term of office in 2024. I think that we have to understand what's going on here as a play within U.S. politics rather than in world political maneuvering.
Interesting thoughts there, David. As always, thank you very much indeed, David Barkin, commentator and economist, joining us out of Mexico City. Now, the coronavirus pandemic continues to take a heavy toll on the Americas, with the United States remaining the most affected country on the continent. According to a tally by Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. set a new daily record of coronavirus cases in 24 hours, with more than 225,000 infections. It's pushed the total caseload to 14.3 million. It's also reported over 2,500 new deaths, raising the overall toll to 278,000. Officials link the new resurgence to the holiday season. In Brazil, the health ministry announced nearly 47,000 new cases, pushing the country's tally to more than 6.5 million. Mexico also registered more than 12,000 new cases and 690 fatalities. Mexican officials say the real number could be significantly higher than what is being reported due to little testing. And U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign has filed another lawsuit in the state of Georgia in an effort to overturn the presidential election results. The legal challenge is aimed at contesting more than 100,000 votes in Georgia. Trump's camp alleges massive irregularities, mistakes, and potential voter fraud. It's the latest in a series of legal bids intended to reverse his loss to President-elect Joe Biden. Georgia's Republican officials have repeatedly said that there had been no evidence of widespread fraud in the November 3rd vote. Trump's team has already suffered multiple court defeats in similar cases filed in other states like Nevada and Wisconsin. 2020 is certain to be recorded as the most violent year in the United States since the crack cocaine era during the 1980s and the early 1990s. Unfortunately for the many victims, the huge increase in homicides has mostly gone unreported in a year full of controversy, violence, and corona-related death. Ramin Mazahari has more from Chicago.
A roundup of headlines from the past week in the United States. In Los Angeles, murders in 2020 are the highest in a decade. In Atlanta, murders are the highest in 30 years. Chicago just reported homicides are up 54% this year and 73% month over month from November 2019, showing that neither cold weather nor the second wave of coronavirus is stopping the absolutely devastating record homicide wave. Murders are almost totally confined to the poorest ghettos, mainly populated by African and Latino American citizens, and are mostly in urban areas, which usually have Democrat mayors.
I think it's bipartisan. When we have violence among the underclass, that's something that everyone's tolerated in the country for too long. One party that embraces gun rights, which happens incidentally to not be the urban party, and then we have another party that's very kind of gun phobic, but neither party gets to the root, and the root of it is insecurity.
Many believe the most basic function of any type of government is to provide physical security. Many also say that the tolerance of gang wars, shootouts with no consequences, and an underclass which essentially suffers from de facto segregation is a reflection of America's endlessly violent national history and foreign policy.
When you sow insecurity and violence and use violence as a method of settling disputes, then the same thing comes home. You can't cause havoc all over the world and drop bombs on 10 countries and not expect to have some retribution at home. So I think that we need to demilitarize our police. I think we need to demilitarize our society. I think we need to demilitarize our foreign policy.
Nationwide, aggravated assaults have skyrocketed about a third as high as homicides. Total crime numbers, including robbery, sex assault, theft, burglary, and murder, are down just 7% in places like Chicago in 2020, providing scant compensation for such widespread loss of life and increased feelings of insecurity. Many nations have kept their schools open despite coronavirus, but across the U.S., schools have mostly been shuttered, causing a rise in juvenile violence. About 350 children have been shot so far this year in Chicago alone. Perhaps because of the coronavirus and the highly disputed presidential election, the record wave of murders has flown under the radar of the national media. But they have devastated poor urban communities and will require years of healing, reconciliation, and investment. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Elsewhere, Chilean police have once again clashed with protesters holding their weekly anti-government rally in the capital, Santiago. The police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the protesters, who in return threw Molotov cocktails and rocks and splashed paint at police vehicles. Chile has been a scene of unrest since October 2019 after a hike in transport fares. The rallies later turned into a movement demanding the resignation of President Sebastián Piñera and broader social equality. The protests led to a successful referendum for constitutional changes in October. Some 30 people, however, have been killed during the rallies so far. And in other news, after a week of negotiations in London, the European Union and the UK failed to bridge significant divergences over their post-Brexit relations. UK and EU top negotiators have paused the talks and given the task of breaking the deadlock to Prime Minister Boris Johnson and President of the European Commission Ursula von der Leyen. Johnson and von der Leyen are expected to discuss the remaining differences in a telephone conversation. The two sides are at loggerheads over a host of issues, including level playing field, governance and fisheries, while both sides avoid compromising. Britain formally left the EU in January but remains bound by the bloc's rules until the transition period ends on December the 31st. Political commentator Ian Williams says the reason Brexit talks have reached a stalemate is that London is so blatantly violating other existing agreements.
It's about how to enforce the agreements. Well, how do you enforce an agreement on somebody who is blatantly violating existing agreements that he's only just conceived? You know, I happen to think that Britain has a very good point on the fish, but they did agree to it. The Europeans get far more of Britain's fish, if you want to put it that way, than any rational division would entitle them to. But the deal was made in the days when it was the case of the British fisheries or the British bankers, and guess who won? It was the fishiness in the City of London that won, not the fish in the North Sea and the Irish Sea. They're tied up in history, and once again it's a whole series of precipitate decisions made by Boris Johnson to get Brexit through and to get himself elected as leader of the Conservative Party, and he's created a monster. He has huge pressure from people behind him, Brexit or bust. He's got people who are waiting to jump at him because the tide of public opinion, as predicted, is turning, and there's a fairly strong majority now would actually say, well, let's stay in after all. So it's not a popular cause he's fighting for. It is a trap of his own devising, and I have very little or no sympathy for him. But I also have very, very low expectations of a reasonable compromise coming out of it.
And as the UK remains in the grip of the COVID-19 pandemic, the country's health officials and experts are deeply concerned about the effects of the virus on Britain's minorities. Our UK correspondent, Richard Sudan, has this report from the British capital.
Earlier this year, Health Secretary Matt Hancock confirmed what many believed in saying that the government was concerned about the potential disproportionate impact on BAME communities of COVID. Indeed, BAME health workers working in the health service in the early days of the pandemic were some of the first to lose their lives on the front line treating those who had contracted the disease.
The lethal effects of COVID resulting in deaths and black and ethnic minority peoples. And that's hugely disproportionate for African descent peoples within that overall black and ethnic minority category. And yet this government has routinely refused to recognise that the consequence of institutionalised racism, enforced poverty, the ethnic pay gap that pushes black and ethnic minority workers into the lowest paid public sector, public facing sector jobs, has resulted in them being overexposed to the vulnerability of COVID.
As well as concerns about structural inequalities impacting COVID, some have also raised concerns about the potential of some medical conditions within BAME communities being impacted by COVID.
There have been papers in the British Medical Journal alerting to the fact that certain blood pressure and diabetes medications do seem to cause, when there is an infection already, it's more likely to escalate into the disastrous lung problems that cause sudden death. So I know that there is a difference between indigenous and BAME communities in this country as regards those problems.
Irrespective of continued debates over health issues within BAME communities, the impact of COVID on those communities due to existing structural inequality is to many undeniable.
We've seen with Belly Malinga and others here in the United Kingdom, a rail worker who was spat upon who later died of COVID, and the doctors overwhelmingly Asian and African, the nurses overwhelmingly African and Asian that have died as a consequence of COVID, being brutally ignored by this government, who are now suggesting that it's down to black people and Asian people's lifestyles why they are more vulnerable to COVID, rather than the brutal realities of institutionalized racism.
As the effects of COVID continue to grip the nation, many people remain deeply concerned about the devastating impact of COVID on some of the country's most marginalized communities.
Although the debate continues, many medical experts believe that COVID-19 disproportionately affects BAME communities already dealing with inequalities within the health service, leading many to ask the question, what do decision makers intend to do about those inequalities? Richard Sudam, London.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden up sins and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
The COVID-19 pandemic has devastated America's nursing homes. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Shefali Milzurek Desai and Tara Scholar Writers. This article is published under the heading Precarious Working Conditions of Nursing Home Employees in the U.S. Foster Spread of COVID-19. Here's the details. The COVID-19 pandemic has devastated America's nursing homes, but the reasons aren't as simple as people might think. To understand how nursing homes became the source of over one-third of U.S. COVID-19 deaths, you have to look beyond just the vulnerability of the residents and examine how nursing homes pay and manage their employees. The average nursing aide earns just $14.25 an hour, less than $30,000 a year. Many are women who work at multiple nursing homes to make their ends meet. Partly as a result of that, the typical nursing home has staff connections to 15 other facilities, each an opportunity for the coronavirus to spread. That risk is magnified by a reluctance among many nursing aides to take sick days when they're ill, even though federal law currently requires employers to provide paid sick leave for coronavirus-related reasons. An alarming number of infections in long-term care facilities in the U.S., nearly half, have been traced to staff who work in multiple healthcare facilities and who engage in presenteeism, meaning they continue to work even after being exposed to or falling ill from COVID-19 pandemic. As law professors who specialize in employment, immigration, and health law, we have spoken with many nursing home aides to try to understand why this is happening and find ways to avoid it, the researcher said. The story of one of them represents that many others have experienced. We will call her Salma rather than use her real name to protect her name from retaliation, the researchers added. Like about a third of nursing aides in the U.S., Salma is an immigrant. She often spends 12 hours a day cooking, cleaning, and caring for residents' most intimate needs, such as bathing, dressing, feeding, and providing medication. When Salma fell ill earlier this year, she requested paid sick leave, but her employer refused to provide it. She tried to assert her rights under her state's paid sick time law, but she said her employer responded by threatening to report her to immigration authorities. When she explained that she had legal status, Salma said her employer changed tactics and threatened to report her to the Internal Revenue Service because no payroll taxes had been deducted from her wages as she was paid off the books. Salma was afraid she would lose her job, so she continued to go to work. The research, drawing on interviews with nursing aides like Salma and emerging studies of other essential workers during COVID-19, shows how employee policies in the U.S. particularly for low pay days, have sharply raised the risks and how access to paid sick leave could lower them. Historical records from previous outbreaks in the U.S., including 1918 influenza pandemic and 2009 H1N1 epidemic, show that immigrants and people of color are most likely to contract and die of infectious diseases. While pre-existing conditions account for the severity of illnesses, they do not explain why these segments of the populations are more likely to become sick in the first place. Data show this is due to large percentages of immigrants and people of color performing essential labor, such as nursing aid roles, that requires close contact with many other people. The research asks why nursing aides are more likely to spread the virus. To answer this question, the examination laws and policies that affect them, including paid sick leave time, were researched. San Francisco became the first U.S. jurisdiction to require paid sick leave in 2006. Other cities continue, and states followed. And now, there are approximately 40 of these laws nationwide. Paid sick leave require employers to pay workers who take time off when they or any family members are sick, injured, or seeking medical treatment. Some laws explicitly allow for paid sick leave during a public health emergency such as COVID-19. Most are based on an accrual model. This means employees must earn paid sick time hours. Typically, 1 hour of paid sick leave is earned for every 30 hours worked. Local paid sick time laws apply to private sector employees and, in some cases, state and local government employees. In March 2020, Congress passed the nation's first universal paid sick leave law. This emergency law, which expires at the end of the year, provides most employees in the U.S. with up to 80 hours of paid leave if the worker has been exposed to, is ill from, or is caring for someone infected with COVID-19. However, a large survey earlier this year showed that many essential low-wage employees still could not access paid sick leave after the law went into effect. That survey and the research show that these employees tend to either believe they have no right to paid leave or that their employer will retaliate if they try to use it. Many fear they could lose their jobs. Even a short period of lost income can be financially devastating for these individuals. Among Latino essential workers, 43% surveyed said they, even while employed, can't earn enough to adequately provide food for their families.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
in the limelight.
Sparked by a new bill that would make publishing photos of police illegal, and a viral video soon after that shows French police brutally beating a black man, it appears that France may be headed for its own George Floyd moment, says Alan McLeod, writer in an article published under the heading, France's new security law may have just sparked a George Floyd moment. Stay tuned for the details, please. Award-winning Syrian photographer Amir Al-Halbi lies dazed on the ground. His head is heavily bruised and bandaged. Blood covers his face, arms, and much of his body. Lengths of cotton wool have been stuffed up his broken nose, giving him an almost comical appearance. Al-Halbi has been badly beaten by French police. But this is Paris, where he was covering ironically huge nationwide protest against police brutality this weekend. Perhaps even more concerning is that new laws pushed through by the government of Emmanuel Macron and passed by France's National Assembly, akin to the U.S. House of Representatives, mean that sharing images of Al-Halbi or other victims of police brutality might soon be considered illegal. Article 24 of the France's new national security bill, which now only needs to be ratified by the Senate, specifically outlaws the publishing and dissemination of images of police that undermine their physical or psychological integrity and is punishable with a fine of up to 45,000 euros and up to 1 year in jail. The bill specifically states that filming police in such a manner would be against the law. But questions have been raised about how liberally authorities would interpret a nebulous language of the new edict is interpreted. Media unions and human rights groups warn that it could prevent journalists from documenting police abuses. The National Assembly's decision to approve the law last week sparked large protests in many major cities around France, including Bordeaux, Lille, Montpellier, and Nantes. However, an incident caught on camera recently threw large amounts of fuel on the fire of resentment, drastically increasing the demonstration size and intensity. Images from mobile phones and closed-circuit television showed an unprovoked police attack on a young black music producer at his place of work. A group of four officers can be seen chasing after Michel Zecler, following him from outside into his studio, where they kick, punch, and beat him with truncheons. Zecler also alleges they shouted racial abuse while they assailed him. Before the videos went viral on social media, the officers testified that Zecler had in fact attacked them and was resisting arrest. The officers have now been charged with deliberate violence and with falsifying statements. Two of the Gang of Four, including a 44-year-old senior officer with a rank of brigadier, remain in custody while two others have been released. The viral images provoked a storm of condemnation across France this weekend and propelled as many as 500,000 people into the streets with demonstrations in dozens of cities. Protesters marched through the streets, setting light to cars, damaging buildings, and clashing with police, of whom a reported 98 were injured nationwide. Many of Paris' iconic boulevards resembled a war zone, as thousands of demonstrators pitched battle with lines of police in riot gear. President Macron said he was very shocked by the footage of the police attack on Zecler, yet continues to be a driving force behind new security law, under which many have noted that the images might never have come to light, given as they essentially identify the Parisian officers and clearly undermine their integrity or authority. Without the footage, it is possible that Zecler would have been facing prosecution himself. Although the bill and the protests against it are dominating French politics, the story has been covered sparsely in the American corporate press, with no coverage whatsoever in MSNBC, CBS News, or CNBC. Fox News, meanwhile, reprinted one Associated Press article featuring an egregious, uncorrected error in its sob headline, asserting that protesters were shooting tear gas at themselves. While foreign desks have been seriously cut in recent years, huge demonstrations in central Paris should not have been too difficult to cover. Lebanese political commentator Sarah Abdullah suggested that if the rallies had been happening in countries antagonistic to the United States, they would have been front-page news. The U.S. Secretary of State is yet to comment on the events in France, suggesting that they are not at the front and center of his thoughts. President Macron came to power in 2017, winning in the final round of the election against far-right challenger Marine Le Pen. A strong believer in neoliberalism and an admirer of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, he has insisted that France must not merely be reformed, but transformed, and has attempted to radically alter the shape of French society, away from a social democratic model to one more resembling the United States of America. Almost immediately after gaining the presidency, however, his average approval rating tumbled and has not risen above 40% since. Indeed, the 42-year-old former investment banker has faced almost constant resistance to his agenda from the general public. His attempts to increase the cost of fuel in 2018 sparked the Yellow Vest movement across France. Meanwhile, his plans to raise the age of retirement and reform France's pension system was met with month-long general strike that paralyzed France last winter. Despite losing over 50,000 people to the coronavirus pandemic, he has seen his popularity increase this year due to the government's financial response to the virus, which included aid to small businesses and paying employees to stay home. Despite this, it appears possible that France might be headed for its own George Floyd moment, where its racial injustices are finally reckoned with.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone. My name is Saeed Pourreza. Our top story: Iran has lambasted the silence of the International Atomic Energy Agency in the face of the murder of its nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Iran's permanent envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, wrote a letter to the agency demanding a clear and unequivocal condemnation of last week's terrorist attack. He went on to urge the IAEA to end the process of unnecessarily publishing detailed information about Iranian locations and scientists, acts which he explained have led to the assassination of Iranian scientists in the past. The letter comes a day after the U.S. announced new sanctions on the Islamic Republic. The Trump administration's policy on Tehran is widely seen as an attempt to inflict maximum damage on the country and to destroy any attempt by the incoming Biden administration to repair the U.S.-Iran ties. Well, let's cross over to Pomo Lesgi, who is in Vienna, to tell us more about this story. And Homa, it's good to see you. Hope all is well. This was a brazen terrorist attack any way you slice it. Why do you think the IAEA is mincing its words condemning it?
Yes, Saeed. Well, we have to first refer to an interview that Mr. Grossi, Rafael Mariano Grossi, the director general of the agency, had earlier with a news agency. And in that interview, when he was asked about this attack, the words he used were, and if I should quote that clearly, "Let me say that we abhor violence of any type. We are an international organization for peace and security." So that's the only thing he said about this terrorist attack. And what the Iranian ambassador here to the agency, Mr. Gharibabadi, says in his letter is basically that this is not what the condemnation that Iran is looking for. This is not the type of attention that the international community should pay to what's happening when it comes to the sabotage attempts against, he says, Iran's nuclear facilities, as well as the threats that Iranian scientists or nuclear experts and those who work in the nuclear industry are facing. And then he refers to the 2010, 2011, and 2012 assassinations of nuclear scientists in Iran. And he says that he believes that the IAEA, since it is at the moment in charge of the most robust verification activities in Iran, has a responsibility to completely, as you say there, clearly, unconditionally, basically renounce this terrorist act and stand with Iran against it, something that Iran says the agency is not doing.
Right. As you say, Iran has spoken its mind, hasn't it? So far we have seen the promise of a harsh response, demands for unequivocal condemnation of the assassination, and a vote by MPs for inspections to stop. Where do you think Iran's cooperation with the IAEA is headed?
But at the moment, as far as the agency itself is concerned, Mr. Grossi has said that he hasn't received any kind of signal or he hasn't seen any indication that Iran wants to reduce its current level of cooperation with the agency. And Iran also hasn't actually said that it is going to do so. But as mentioned in various statements by Mr. Gharibabadi in his addresses to the IAEA Board of Governors, Iran has that as an option on the table and will have it as an option, because Iran has said that at the moment it is continuing to cooperate with the agency, but if it reaches the conclusion that their confidentiality is not going to be preserved, then this could actually affect the level of cooperation. I'll just quickly add here, Saeed, if I can, just in the past half hour, we had another tweet by Mr. Gharibabadi in which he said that he was criticizing the fact that another report by the agency concerning a confidential letter by Iran to the agency has been leaked to the press again just today. And he was saying in that tweet that he believes that this is against the confidentiality agreement that Iran and the agency have, and that the agency should try and form a means of communication where confidential contents of letters or information regarding Iran's nuclear activities is not leaked to the press immediately, he says, even before members of the board themselves can track it down.
Right. And let's also talk about the nuclear deal and this idea, the indication that Joe Biden, the incoming president, will return to the JCPOA. We're yet to see that happen, though. But one thing we know is that in the past, the toughest sanctions on Iran were imposed by the Democrats, from Jimmy Carter in the 1970s to Clinton in the 1990s and all the rest of them. What are the odds of Biden being any different?
Yes, in fact, I do remember that when the sides were signing the nuclear agreement or were getting near conclusion when it came to the nuclear agreement in 2015, the Obama administration still made these statements that it was because of these increased pressure and sanctions that Iran actually was forced to come to the negotiating table and agree to this nuclear deal. When it comes to the Biden administration, at the moment, the administration has said that if Iran goes back to full compliance to the nuclear deal, then the Biden administration would be ready to come back to the nuclear agreement. But that, on the ground, we're not sure how's that going to work out, because Iran, on the other hand, has said it will, you know, go back to its previous full compliance once the other sides meet their commitments, once sanctions are lifted. So it's going to be also about who's going to go first, and if that is going to happen, is there going to be a situation where both sides can be sure that this is going to work and the JCPOA can survive?
Right. Well, it's only a matter of time, Homa. We'll have to wait and see. Homa Lesgi in Vienna for us. Nice speaking with you. To other news now, an update in the case of a 12-year-old British Somali girl who drowned in a river in Manchester in June 2019. A coroner has concluded Shukri Abdi's death was an accident. Ahmed Kabbala was at the inquest and sent us this.
So we've just come out of the coroner's court, where after a 39-page report that took roughly an hour and a half, the coroner reached her conclusion that the death of Shukri Abdi was an accidental death and not the result of criminal negligence or manslaughter. Now, she did suggest that Child One did have a duty of care to Shukri Abdi, and that by leading Shukri Abdi into deep water, into a river, when she knew that Shukri Abdi could not swim, and letting go of her hand and allegedly pushing her away, she did fail in her duty of care. However, this did not result in criminal negligence, because the child was in unfamiliar water in a part of the river that she had not been before. Now, many people will analyse the court case, will analyse the police reaction to it, and they will make the conclusions that Shukri Abdi was a black Muslim refugee, and because of that, the due diligence wasn't taken by the officers at the time in investigating this case. Now, that wasn't discussed today in the court, but it will be discussed by campaigners that have raised the flag and raised the case and the profile of the Shukri Abdi case. And I have a feeling that this case, this profile, the Justice for Shukri Abdi campaign will continue, because they feel that justice hasn't been served today, and that the family has not received justice despite the coroner's conclusion, in which he essentially told the family to move on and remember Shukri Abdi for the girl that she is, instead of the way that she died.
Well, the inquiry into Shukri Abdi's death was forced by a public campaign given momentum by the Black Lives Matter movement. The little girl's family have said they'd continue to fight the case in the courts. We spoke with the family's lawyer, who complained of institutional racism during the investigation.
Institutional racism in this country takes many forms. And in these sorts of cases, what you often see is a situation where either complaints are not taken seriously, brushed under the carpet, and that has been the family's position throughout from the beginning, that the police were not listening to them. It was a real struggle for their voices to be heard. But then when you speak about voices being heard, you often, in the case of institutional racism, you see examples where an officer, for example, is speaking to a person from a black or minority ethnic background, and they shout at them. And you think, why are you shouting? It doesn't help for you, for the person to understand. Your volume in voice doesn't mean they will understand you better. But that's what they do. Either they won't hear you, so you brush it through the carpet, or they will hear you, and you're shouting. So you can't win. And that, for me, is one of the backbones of institutional racism.
Still in this country, off the back of a second national lockdown and with the effects of COVID-19 still gripping the nation, health experts remain deeply concerned about the effects of the virus on Britain's BAME communities. This report by correspondent Richard Sedan.
Earlier this year, Health Secretary Matt Hancock confirmed what many believed in saying that the government was concerned about the potential disproportionate impact on BAME communities of COVID. Indeed, BAME health workers working in the health service in the early days of the pandemic were some of the first to lose their lives on the front line treating those who had contracted the disease.
the lethal effects of COVID, resulting in deaths and black and ethnic minority peoples. And that's hugely disproportionate for African descent peoples within that overall black and ethnic minority category. And yet this government has routinely refused to recognize that the consequence of institutionalized racism, enforced poverty, the ethnic pay gap that pushes black and ethnic minority workers into the lowest paid public sector, public facing sector jobs, has resulted in them being overexposed to the vulnerability of COVID.
As well as concerns about structural inequalities impacting COVID, some have also raised concerns about the potential of some medical conditions within BAME communities being impacted by COVID.
There have been papers in the British Medical Journal alerting to the fact that certain blood pressure and diabetes medications do seem to cause, when there is an infection already, it's more likely to escalate into the disastrous lung problems that cause sudden death. So I know that there is a difference between Indigenous and BAME communities in this country as regards those problems.
Irrespective of continued debates over health issues within BAME communities, the impact of COVID on those communities due to existing structural inequality is to many undeniable.
We've seen with Belly Malinga and others here in the United Kingdom, a rail worker who was spat upon who later died of COVID, and the doctors overwhelmingly Asian and African, the nurses overwhelmingly African and Asian that have died as a consequence of COVID being brutally ignored by this government, who are now suggesting that it's down to black people and Asian people's lifestyles why they are more vulnerable to COVID rather than the brutal realities of institutionalized racism.
As the effects of COVID continue to grip the nation, many people remain deeply concerned about the devastating impact of COVID on some of the country's most marginalized communities.
Although the debate continues, many medical experts believe that COVID-19 disproportionately affects BAME communities already dealing with inequalities within the health service, leading many to ask the question, what do decision makers intend to do about those inequalities? Richard Sudam, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Former Maltese Prime Minister Joseph Muscat is facing a public inquiry into the murder of journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. She was killed in a bomb blast near her home in 2017. Activists and the political opposition say Muscat protected people linked to the murder. Muscat, who stepped down as Prime Minister in January this year, denies any wrongdoing. The former PM has close ties to several people under criminal investigation for Galizia's murder. The victim was an acclaimed investigative reporter who made a career exposing rampant corruption, cronyism, nepotism, and organized crime in Maltese politics. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said he hoped France would get rid of what he called the Macron trouble very soon. Speaking to reporters, the president described the French leader as a burden on France, who has led the nation into a very dangerous period. The Turkish leader's comments come just a day after France announced it would be launching a massive and unprecedented attack on 76 mosques deemed to be extremist by the government's controversial definition of Islamic extremism. Erdogan has previously stated that his French counterpart needed a mental check for his separatist attitudes on Muslims. Thousands of Armenians have taken to the capital Yerevan, blocking major roads and bringing traffic to a standstill in the latest round of demonstrations to hit the country. They're calling for the resignation of the Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan over a ceasefire deal they say prematurely locked in Azeri territorial gains in the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh last month. The PM says the deal was a disaster, but it staved off a large-scale defeat. Despite a coalition of 17 opposition parties naming a potential caretaker prime minister to replace him, Pashinyan is refusing to step down, saying he is now responsible for ensuring national security and stabilizing Armenia. As Brexit negotiations reach their conclusion, ministers in the UK and leaders throughout the EU will be keen to unpick all the other details, as the threat of no deal remains a real possibility. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, some in the EU may in fact favor a no deal scenario.
Good morning.
Open up.
A deal is imminent. These are the latest murmurings to leak from the Brexit negotiations between the United Kingdom and the European Union. As we approach the 11th hour, differences remain, but the reality of the circumstances are becoming ever clearer.
We are negotiating, and of course I follow closely the process of negotiation, but we will see in the next hours or in the next days what will be on the table, and we will need to assess the situation. And this will be a question at the end of the negotiation. We need to decide, the member states, they will need to decide. Like the British side, will need to say yes or no. And the member states will say yes or no.
If progress is made, all 27 member states have to agree and ratify the deal in the European Parliament. France, however, have been very vocal. If the deal does not suit them, they will veto the agreement and send both sides into a no-deal outcome.
France is committed to our interests. We need to prepare ourselves for a no deal, meaning that on December 31st, we would no longer have free movement and free access to the British market, and vice versa. But that's not what we desire. Negotiations are continuing as we speak, but I also want to tell our fishermen, our companies, and our citizens we will not accept a bad deal. If the deal does not correspond with our interests, we will oppose it.
While many see such sentiments as negotiating tactics, some believe France actually wants a no-deal outcome. Economically, they will be affected, but it will be the UK that will feel the impact the hardest. France still has free trade with Europe and all nations that have trade agreements with the Union. The UK, however, will be limited to World Trade Organization tariffs. In this way, a no-deal outcome gives France the opportunity to fill the void left by the UK, who will find themselves increasingly isolated. A no deal can also lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom. This will significantly impact the global standing of Westminster, who have recently been overtaken by India